16th century education and the Bible. A thoughtful person will recognize in the education of the 16th century the beginning of our own system of public instruction. Unfortunately, studies in humanistic education have been neglected lately. Educators, under the impact of the philosophy of American pragmatism, tend to scorn the aims, curricula, and methods of the schools of the 16th century. Historians have been guilty of simply overlooking this important field of research. The Renaissance educators stressed the value of a liberal education, a system dedicated not to materialistic, but to humane values. In our age of rule by the machine, we have somehow lost human values. Our young people seem more keenly aware of the shallowness of our life than their elders. There's turmoil in American education today, from the local PTA association at the bottom to the graduate school at the top. Perhaps historical studies like the following can help to regain lost perspectives. It might even be true that the humanist educators of the Reformation era have something worthwhile to contribute toward a solution of today's problem. Section number one, the context of 16th century education. I'm going to leave this part out. A couple of weeks ago, after most of my work was done, I received a letter that this was to be limited to 28 minutes, and I have 44 minutes. So I'm going to leave out part one, which gives the medieval background, education in the Middle Ages as it grew into the Renaissance system. And also has a part on the attitude of the purpose of schools. The material here is from the writings of Melanchthon, Luther, and Bucer, in which I go into Hübner, Friedrich Hübner, Natürliche Theologie und Theokratische Schwärmerei by Melanchthon, and find that Melanchthon indeed had some theocratic views in his education system that were rather out of place. For example, he speaks of the duty of the government as promoting the proclamation of the gospel through the school. This is from the point of view of his own theology, Melanchthon's own theology, a confounding of the place of law and gospel in the social order. Part two, of course, Bucer makes the same mistake, not in his early writings, but in his later writing, his De Regno Christi. Part two, religion in 16th century schools. Since this study concentrates upon the humanistic Latin schools, we shall start with several generalizations about the vernacular schools and the universities, which we cannot treat in the paper in detail. It's simply not true that the Bible was neither published, read, nor studied in the late Middle Ages. The studies of J. Michael Roy into the use of the Bible in the medieval period, and those of Hastings Rashdow into the predominance of the Bible in the theological curriculum of the medieval university, makes the contrary claims of vulgar Protestantism antiquated and untenable. However, it is true that these generalizations do not always apply to the situation in the schools before the Reformation. There is almost no surviving literature to indicate either that the scriptures were taught to children in the medieval schools or that the priests received this kind of training in preparation for their work. In fact, serious teaching of the Bible, even in Protestant schools, is more a mark of the 17th than of the 16th century, since the catechism was dominant during the first years of the Reformation. Some historians have wrongly assumed that only religion was taught in early Protestant schools. Like their medieval precursors, the Latin schools of the 16th century had very little structured teaching in religion. However, the vernacular schools were religious-oriented. These folk schools prepared talented children for the Latin schools, and provided a terminal education in reading, writing, and religion for those who were not to go on. It was one of the principles of the Protestant Reformation that every believer, as a priest before God, must be able to read his own Bible, hymn book, and catechism. In the villages where there was no regular schoolmaster, it was the duty of the sexton to instruct the children. There is a whole area, I have a very lengthy footnote, about the use of the cruster, or the sexton, its place in Western education. It's much greater than a person would imagine. So the old office of the assistant at Mass, the Mass Deaner, was adapted to Protestantism in such a way that a significant contribution was made toward universal education. Luther, Melanchthon, Bucer, and other reformers called for compulsory education. In revising the office of sexton and prescribing certain educational requirements for it, the church orders of the Reformation provided the institution by which simple schools, at least, could be provided everywhere. This arrangement, especially clear in the epoch-making school order prepared for Duke Christoph of Württemberg by Johann Brentz, made possible the rapid implementation of a program of literacy as it was first achieved in the various states of Germany in the 17th and 18th centuries. At the university level, incidentally, there's the same office developed in Norway, and the Klokker in Norway is the origin of the common school system of Norway in the post-Reformation period. At the university level, men like Luther were lecturing on books in the Bible long before one could speak of a Protestant Reformation. When Melanchthon was called to Wittenberg in 1518 as professor for Greek studies, he started at once to lecture on the Bible. Gradually, the sentences of Peter the Lombard were displaced by biblical exegesis on the university curriculum. However, it's worth noting that Melanchthon's Loci Communes, which perhaps began as annotations on the sentences of Peter the Lombard, won a secure place in the offerings of the secondary schools as well as the universities. Luther's small catechism and the Loci Communes, often in simplified versions, tended to usurp the place one should have expected the Bible to occupy if indeed Luther and Melanchthon held to the sola scriptura, as of course they did. Etliche lernen gar nichts aus der heiligen Schrift. Etliche lernen die Kinder gar nichts denn die heilige Schrift, welche beide nicht zu leiden sind. Melanchthon complained in 1528. Some teach absolutely nothing from the Holy Scriptures. Others teach the children nothing but the Holy Scriptures. Both of these is not to be suffered. If, as we have seen, the Bible played a prominent role in the university curriculum, at least for theological students, and if the vernacular schools specialized in religion, what part did the Bible play in the Latin schools? Much less than we expect, at least so far as structured courses in Bible in the 16th century are concerned. The typical school schedule provided for full days of instruction on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. The courses offered on these days were devoted almost exclusively to study of the classical languages and the liberal arts. The schools convened half days on Wednesday and Saturday, when time was devoted to religious instruction, largely catechetical and biblical in nature. By the way, not exclusively to religious instruction. At some places, the schools taught courses in religion on Sundays. Now, this may seem like a meager allotment in an age in which the question of religion was supreme. However, it must be remembered that Christian concepts pervaded the entire curriculum. Grammars commonly used as illustrations, verses taken from the Bible or catechism. In language courses, pupils might be assigned the task of translating the catechism into Latin or Greek. When history was studied, theological lessons were drawn from the pages of history. The school day commonly opened with the singing of a Latin hymn, such as the Veni Creator Spiritus, and likely ended with another hymn or prayer or both. Especially in the first half of the century, pupils commonly were dismissed from classes to attend daily matins in the morning and vespers each afternoon. They were expected to serve as choir boys at these services, as well as in the Sunday Mass. Music was usually taught daily the first hour after lunch. That would be the 4 days, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. Much of the time in music was probably devoted to the church hymns, sequences, psalms, other scripture selections, and settings of the ordinary and propers of the Mass. In many schools, Luther's small catechism was recited in a daily rotation with the Ten Commandments on Monday, the Creed on Tuesday, etc. One could be a little more explicit and say schools, the orders of which were written by Johann Bugenhagen, followed this custom, the daily recitation of the catechism. Part three, methods of instruction. While the educators of the Reformation often showed much imagination in classroom methods, most of what they did was not new. From medieval educators, they learned the use of audio and visual aids, dramatizations, casting their lesson materials in the form of riddles, and the like. But there was one concept which made their approach completely different from that which had gone before, at least in their own opinion. It was the cry of the humanists, ad fontes, back to the sources. They criticized the medieval schoolmen for neglecting the classical authors and the sacred scriptures and instead using corrupted texts and scholastic tradition. The human pedagogue insisted not the corrupted texts and commentaries of the Middle Ages, but back to the original authors themselves, not the comments over what Peter the Lombard had commented regarding theological questions, nor ceaseless wrangling over the theories of Duns Scotus and William of Ockham, but back to the source of Christian knowledge, the Bible itself. There might be some truth in the assertion by Georg Maritz that in this insistence upon the original sources, so tenaciously demanded by the 16th century Protestant educators, lay the beginning of the modern scientific method. Like their medieval predecessors, the schoolmasters of the Reformation era held a high opinion of the value of memorization. This was not only because of the relative scarcity and expensiveness of books, but also because they felt it was an important technique for learning. Of course, the humanists recognized that what was to be memorized ought first to be understood. Erasmus, in his book De Pueris Instituendis, paragraph 33, wrote as follows, "Believe me, there is only one sound mnemonic art, and it has three rules: understand, arrange, repeat." In Strasbourg, which was blessed with an abundance of skilled educators, Johann Sturm expressed his views on the value of memorization. He held that the faculty for learning by heart was most pronounced between the ages of 6 and 10, and that one's ability to remember was improved by practice. The first humanist to produce a psychology of education was Juan Luis Vives, whatever we might think of his most famous royal pupil, whom the English Puritans like to dub Bloody Mary. At any rate, Vives taught that erudition was formed by the instruments of intelligence, memory, and diligent study. And he added, quote, memory is enlarged by exercise, and warned that neglect would put it to flight. While the humanist educators expected their pupils to do much memorizing, a perusal of their writings reveals that they tried to make learning as simple as possible, and that they constantly warned that the children not be overburdened. The rule was, non multa sed multum. Educators such as Johann Sturm, you always have to give his first name because Jakob or Jacob Sturm is also important and is an educator at Strasbourg. There's no relation between these two Sturms. Educators like Johann Sturm urged independent study, both inside and outside the school. Erasmus had suggested that the student collect his own books of quotations, as Erasmus had published his adages. To these practices was added an emphasis upon writing and composition. These often served the additional purpose of providing material for the students' declamations or speeches, since schools in the tradition of Cicero and Quintilian, of course, devoted much attention to effective self-expression in writing and speech. To make the materials more palatable, the educators often presented it in the form of verse. Thus, Eobanus Hessus prepared the Old Testament Psalter in a versified Latin version, which, as a school text, passed through about 40 editions in 70 years. Nicolaus Seneker set the Small Catechism into verse. Textbooks were beautifully illustrated with woodcuts or etchings, another part of the aspect that Dr. Cole spoke about, the books of the 16th century. The medieval practice of placing materials on wall cards or wall charts was continued. A rich use was made of music. Since much biblical instruction centered in the ancient gospel selections read in the churches and then discussed in the school, usually on Saturday morning, the music, which was practiced on Saturday at some other time of the week, was directly related to the sermon text for Sunday. Debating, which was popular in the Middle Ages, was continued, and then there was the use of drama. I think one of the really intriguing parts of the story. We know that dialogue was utilized in teaching, at least as far back as Socrates and Plato. The ancients wrote and produced great tragedies and comedies to discuss the great issues of their day. Medieval authors produced the great religious plays, Nativities and Passions. The humanists prized this institution, and men like Reuchlin and Erasmus produced dramatic literature. As a young boy, Melanchthon had pleased Reuchlin by presenting one of his comedies at a banquet in Pforzheim, to which the famous Hebrew scholar had been invited. As the story goes, Reuchlin was so pleased that he returned the compliment by changing his brilliant young grandnephew's name from Philip Schwarzert to Philip Melanchthon. At any rate, the humanist schools of the 16th century made a great deal of the writing and producing of school plays, down to the famous theatrical performances of the Jesuit schools in the 17th century, which, as we know, ran a regular theater. Martin Luther spoke out in favor of presenting plays in school. Plays by such classical authors as Terence and Plautus were learned and presented. School orders of such places as Hamburg, 1529, Magdeburg, 1553, Brandenburg, 1564, Breslau, 1570, Nordhausen, 1583, and Oschersleben, 1589, for example, specified the producing of a certain number of plays each year. Incidentally, these references are in the script, which I think will be published somewhere or other, and nearly all of them are from Formbaum, Schulordnungen, or the 16th Jahrhundert. Johann Sturm prescribed that plays by Aristophanes, Euripides, and Sophocles be constantly in preparation in a sort of system of rotation among the three upper classes of the gymnasium at Strasbourg. And again, Sturm's views on drama are in this same volume by Formbaum, with Sturm's famous tract, De Literarum Ludis Recte Operiendis, of 1538. One man whom we associate with the writing of plays to teach the biblical history is the celebrated Sebastian Chatillon, or Castellio, known as the champion of religious liberty and toleration in his age. His sacred dialogues went through more than 100 editions. Here is a sample of how Castellio presented the trial of Paul before Ananias out of Acts 23. Paul, men, brothers, up to the present time, I have always served God with a good conscience. Ananias, somebody hit him in the mouth. Paul, God will hit you, you painted wall. How can you dare to judge me by the law and command that I be struck contrary to the law? Attendant, do you dare to shout at the high priest of God? Paul, brethren, I didn't know that this was the high priest. Yes, it's written in Scripture, thou shalt not revile the ruler of thy people. Now listen to the truth, brothers who are present in this assembly. I am a Pharisee and the son of a Pharisee. The charge against me is that I hope in the resurrection of the dead. A Sadducee, the clever rascal, he hopes to get out of it that way. A Pharisee, he has spoken well. I see nothing wrong in him. Perhaps an angel or a spirit has spoken to him. Let's not fight against God. Sadducee, you're defending yourselves now because he claims to agree with you. Pharisee, we're defending him because he deserves our defense. What's he really done wrong? Do you want to attack the innocent? Sadducee, it's really the other way around. Do you want to protect the guilty? And then the Roman commander, Lysias, something's got to be done or this man will be pulled apart. You, command the army to go down there and bring him up into the castle. Castellio wrote a whole book in this style, and it's really very nice. And then part four, books used in teaching the Bible. That is in the 16th century schools. One of the best ways to judge an educational system and its teachers and pupils is to examine the books that they use. We're fortunate to have a lot of source material of this kind, including both the school books themselves and also the school orders which specified how the classes were to be taught. And they get very much into detail if you've examined some of these 16th century school orders. Besides the well-known collections of the works of Luther, Melanchthon, Bucer, and others, we might refer to several that are not so familiar. There are a number of volumes offering materials left out of the Corpus Reformatorum edition of Melanchthon's works, especially those bearing the title of the Supplementa Melanchthoniana. And Dr. Hammer is sitting here in the room, and I have about 20 or 30 references from his bibliography to some of the important supplements to the Corpus Reformatorum in Dr. Hammer's very important book, Die Melanchthon-Forschung im Wandel der Jahrhunderte. Then there is the scholarly four-volume set edited by Ferdinand Kors, offering catechetical materials that preceded Luther's Small Catechism of 1529, an amazing work. Most massive of all is the 11-volume set edited by Johann Michael Roy, under the title Quellen zur Geschichte des kirchlichen Unterrichts im protestantischen Deutschland zwischen 1530 und 1600, in 11 fat volumes, one volume of over 900 pages being devoted to the biblical literature and serving as the source of much of what I'm about to say. Roy discusses the biblical literature in volume 2, and then with the inevitable Nachträge in other volumes, under the following categories: biblical histories, books of memory verses, commentaries on the ancient epistle and gospel selections, and Bible study aids, or introductions, if you prefer that word, introductions to the Bible. We shall briefly review these materials, most of these having been assembled by Roy, some of them coming from Course and other sources. First, however, let us pause to note how the Bible was directly used in 16th century schools. In general, the biblical text was used without much comment, chiefly in services. It was felt that a knowledge of the general content of Scripture belonged to an education, however. Erasmus wrote, quote, "To understand such a poet as Prudentius, the one Christian poet of real literary taste, a knowledge of sacred history is indispensable." It's rather strange, this somewhat peripheral reason he gives for getting to know the Scriptures. Most of the other educators gave deeper reasons. Bucer, for example, quote, "that we through the gospel might be taught and led to live in harmonious faith unto Christ and God," or Luther, who said, "God's word is like a seething torrent which cannot be restrained by any force. It works according to its nature that it brings salvation to those who believe." In an age where all Christian denominations seem to be trying to outdo each other in stripping themselves of the marks of Catholicity, one is almost surprised to note the reverence of the Wittenberg Reformers toward the cultural heritage of the Catholic Church. The story that the Reformers abolished the use of Latin is completely false, both in regards to the church service and to the school program. This isn't a lecture on Protestant music and liturgies. Maybe it should be. But we know that even in the days of Bach, the services in the St. Thomas Church in Leipzig were often conducted in the Latin language. And this is the reason that he produced so much Latin music. It was his job. He was paid to do it. In his Deutsche Messe of 1526, Luther insisted that the vernacular services Luther insisted that the vernacular services were only for the benefit of the uneducated, and added, "At no event do I wish the Latin language to be abolished in the divine service, since I am concerned for the youth," that is, the youth need the Latin service. But even where Latin services were discontinued, there was a general concern to train the youth to read the Bible in Latin versions. Of course, it was the goal of a humanistic school to read the Old Testament in Hebrew and the New Testament in Greek, and then the Old Testament in the Greek Septuagint, and the New Testament in one of the Hebrew translations of the day. In spite of anti-Jewish sentiment among such late medieval elements as the monks at Cologne, the Hebrew text had been available at least since the appearance of the Brescia text, 1494. Reuchlin's publications, that appeared under the title 1506, the Rudimenta Linguae Hebraice, had provided a lexicon and a grammar. Luther could read the Hebrew Old Testament before he knew enough Greek to use the New Testament in the original language. 10 years later, Erasmus issued the first printed edition of the Novum Instrumentum Omne, which, besides the Greek text, provided a new Latin translation together with interpretive notes. Although the most famous, Erasmus' Greek text was by no means the best. It was prematurely rushed into print in order to gain the market before the expected appearance of the famous polyglot Bible of Cardinal Ximenes. This is the Cardinal Ximenes, the Inquisitor, etc., one of the great scholars of the whole period. And his polyglot Bible, I've been reading in German, his polyglot Bible, is a remarkable piece of work. Nor was Erasmus's by any means the only Latin revision of the century. For example, Luther and Melanchthon got out the Wittenberg Latin Bible, even if this version of 1529 was later suppressed by the Gymnasio Lutherans for polemical reasons. They didn't like the way Acts 3, verse 2 was translated. Actually, a veritable flood of Latin versions, prepared by Roman Catholic and Protestant scholars alike, appeared during the course of the 16th century. The list of authors of these Latin versions reads like a who's who of the period. Besides those already mentioned, they included all three Osianders, Ecolampadius, Zwingli, Leo Jude, or Jude, who was already mentioned today, Calvin, Castellio, and Beza among the Protestants, and Stephanus, Cardinal Cajetan, and Pogninus from the Roman Catholic circles. Naturally, the question of whether the Latin language should be Ciceronian, medieval, or somewhere in between was discussed with much feeling. Castellio attempted to take a middle position, but of course he couldn't resist the temptation of replacing some of the most reprehensible terms of the Vulgate with more classical usage. Thus the church in his New Testament, or he published a whole Bible, but the church becomes the res publica instead of ecclesia. Angels were genii rather than angeli, and the word lavacrum was preferred for baptism, and God was promoted from Deus to Jupiter. This aroused a lot of comment, notably by Theodore Beza, who was properly shocked at these heretical variances, so that Beza, after making acrimonious protests, produced his own, more correctly stilted version some years afterwards, is his reply to Castellio. Of course, the vernacular versions were far more influential than any of these versions in the three classical tongues. Luther's German Bible, said to have created the modern High German language, set the pace for a series of vernacular Bibles, many of which were to have a similar function in their own countries, that is, of forming a new vernacular language. Whatever the language used, the biblical text was most often encountered by the pupils in the daily matins and vespers in a town like Wittenberg. There, Luther insisted that the lessons be read by the appointed pupils, first in Latin and only repeated in German, for the sake of townspeople who could not understand the Latin. The ancient pericope series of epistles and gospel selections were retained in the Lutheran churches. Since schoolboys were expected to attend the Mass, it was a natural development when these biblical selections were studied in the school, and textbooks were written to assist in expounding these texts. In Wittenberg, Schleswig-Holstein, Württemberg, and Breslau, it was prescribed that the ancient gospel that would be read in the Mass the next day be expounded to the pupils on Saturday morning. In Breslau, the gospel was then discussed also on Monday morning by way of repetition. Among the expositions of the pericopes were publications by Georg Fabricius, Andreas Pangratius, and two pupils of Melanchthon, also noteworthy for their contributions to music and liturgics, Johann Spangenberg, and most notably, Lucas Lucius of Lüneburg. Besides these might be mentioned several collections of Bible memory verses which followed the liturgical year and hence were also used in explaining the epistles and gospels. Their authors numbered the eminent reformers Veit Dietrich of Nuremberg and Johann Matthäus of Joachimsthal, both of whom were pupils of Melanchthon. It's no surprise to us that the pupils of Melanchthon occur and reoccur. The first evangelical book of memory material seems to have been that from the pen of Melanchthon himself, the Etliche Sprüche, darin das ganze christliche Leben Gefast
Est,
1527. Other men from the Melanchthon circle who followed the example of their mentor in authoring such books were Lucas Lucius, Andreas Musculus, Valentin Trutzendorf, and Petrus Artapoius. A few more words should be said about the last two men. In Valentin Trutzendorf, we meet one of the most effective pedagogues and classroom teachers of the 16th century. He first took over the school at Goldberg in 1525, where, except for a few lengthy leaves of absence, he stayed for the remaining 31 years of his life. This versatile schoolmaster became famous for the imaginative innovations in teaching and for the hundreds of loyal pupils who went forth from his school, many to follow his inspiring example by taking up the teaching profession. From the pen of this great educator, we have the popular Rosarium, a book of 759 Bible verses, arranged according to the Gospels of the liturgical year. The book got its rosy title because the collection of golden texts were seen as a bouquet of roses. Growing out of 20 years' experience in the classroom, many later editions were published by his pupils with many changes. Its attractiveness was enhanced by the addition of Greek and Hebrew columns to complement the original bilingual Latin and German form under which it first appeared. I'm sure that these polyglot versions were especially beloved by the schoolboys. We come to Pater Becker, who went by the Latinized form Petrus Artapoius, which I think is sort of amusing. Artapoius, baker of bread. Artapoius has come to the attention of scholars only in recent years. He was born at Kesslin, Pomerania, about 1491, studied at Wittenberg University, apparently without having formed the customary deep ties with Melanchthon there, returned to Kesslin to teach, and after being driven out by the clergy of the old church, took up a teaching position first at Rügenwalde and then moved on to Stettin, where he spent the rest of his life. Artapoius was on friendly terms with the controversial Sebastian Münster, just mentioned, and sided also with Andreas Osiander in the dispute over justification, a position which cost him his position in the last years of his life. Of special interest is Artapoius' book, Discretio Locorum Legis et Evangelii. As the title indicates, he arranged Bible verses according to the distinction of law and gospel for the children to memorize. First, he presented texts which reflected the threats of divine judgment and then the promises of divine mercy in accordance with the Lutheran doctrine of law and gospel. This was followed by a list of Bible stories illustrating this doctrinal distinction, a circumstance which suggests the fact that in the classroom, this book was intended to be used as a handbook to the Bible itself. The volume concluded with a list of 124 definitions of doctrinal commonplaces, something like Melanchthon's much later Definitiones, which appeared, I think, a good score of years after Artapoius' book of the same title. Pedagogically, the soundest approach in presenting the Bible to children should be Bible history. Children like stories, and the Bible has excellent stories. This approach was not fully developed until the 17th century. Nevertheless, it's not correct to say that it didn't appear earlier. There was a long precedence in the Middle Ages, the famous Biblia Pauperum, or Pauper's Bibles, were collections of pictures illustrating Bible stories for the benefit of the illiterate. Generally, short captions identified these pictures. More significant were the Passionalia, books devoted to the passion history of Christ, together with woodcuts or copper etchings. Distinguished artists such as Albrecht Dürer and Lucas Cranach worked on these books. Oftentimes, medieval passionales contained more saints' legends than biblical material. A passionale published at Nuremberg in 1526 had been compiled from the lucubrations of Erasmus. Roy lists 12 printed editions of Bible histories that are known to have appeared between 1474 and 1508, some in Latin, some in German. It could perhaps safely be said that one of the most unknown works of Luther is his Passionale of 1529. In this, Luther tried to give up the legendary materials so dear to the medieval reader, and he confined himself to the Passion history. But he developed the sufferings of Christ in relation to the entire Heilsgeschichte. Thus, he gave a condensed history of the entire Bible. However, Luther's Passionale was not the first Protestant biblical history. This distinction goes to Otto Brunfels, or Braunfels, as you prefer, more famed in history as the father of modern botany, but also important as an author of religious literature. Brunfels was a teacher in the school of the Carmelite cloister in Strasbourg from 1524 to 1533. In 1527 appeared his biblical history under the title Catalogi Virorum Illustrium Veteris et Novi Testamenti. Some critics will no doubt be tempted to suggest that Brunfels should have stuck to botany. For this little book, which occupies 32 pages in Roy's reprint, devotes about 26 pages to Old Testament personages and events, and the selection of stories places undue emphasis on some of the unsavory characters, such as Onan, Athaliah, or Judas, in a manner hardly appropriate to young school children. Like several other Strasburgers, Brunfels seems to have had a special liking for women, who were generously represented in the book. Bainton, you know, is just doing his studies in Zell of Strasbourg and Catherine Zell. He gave a paper at Hickory a month ago on Catherine Zell. Bucer also liked women. In his Catalogi, Braunfels devotes 45 lines to Queen Athaliah in the Old Testament, while the Mother of Christ rates just 5 lines. In spite of some of these rather peculiar features of the book, it was immensely popular and demonstrated a need in the schools and in the lives of the children. The finest biblical history is probably the one by Sebastian Castellio, of which we have already taken a sample, his Dialogi Sacri. Roy lists 67 editions that appeared between 1543 and 1600, and 33 more that were published after 1600. Both as to form and content, Castellio's book was a distinguished example of humanist textbooks. I would just like to stop a moment and say that I meant to say while we were talking about Brunfels, if you, like I, have looked and looked for information on Brunfels, it's hard to find. And there is a very, very lengthy treatment on Brunfels, together with a bibliography of 2 or 3 pages in fine print in Course, volume 3, page 187 to 195. I haven't found anywhere comparable material on Brunfels. Excuse me for going back. I've just talked about this work of Castellio, probably the best of its period. Other biblical histories were published by Lucas Lucius, Hartmann Bayer, and Joachim Camerarius. Lucius's, like Luther's, was an elaboration of the traditional Passionale. Bayer's book was a large volume containing 256 woodcut illustrations and running into just hundreds and hundreds of pages. You wonder what the children really used it for. Of special interest was the work of Camerarius, closest friend and biographer of Philip Melanchthon. This volume, confined to the New Testament, was entitled Historiae Jesu Christi, etc., on and on. These works, as we know, have 5, 10, 15 lines in their titles. In this highly original work, Camerarius attempted to write a scientific life of Jesus in which scriptural materials were collated with extra-biblical sources of ancient history. Great humanist scholar and historian that he was, he tried to date the birth of Christ, the beginning of his public ministry, and similar matters, and fit him into ancient history. The final category, consisting of Bible study helps, is the shortest in respect to number of items in Roy's Quelle. Introductions to the biblical literature were offered by Petrus Palladius, Johann Pappus, Lucas Luscius, and Michael Neander. These texts provided general information on the makeup of the Bible as a book, guides to its contents, or choice quotations drawn from the various books of the Bible. They were evidently intended to lead their users into a direct confrontation with the Scriptures and to provide them with meaningful insights into the greater context. Conclusion. The uses of the Bible in the schools of the Reformation era were not as thorough as in later centuries. One reason was likely the lack of precedent. Another was the stronger feeling of Catholicity, at least in German circles. It was not before the full impact of the decrees of the Council of Trent, the Counter-Reformation, and the Wars of Religion had made their impact, together with the Enlightenment of the 18th century, that Protestantism lost its historical moorings and got into an un-Catholic biblicism. In retrospect, one can see much that was good in the schools and churches of the 16th century. Perhaps this was embodied in the careers of two of Melanchthon's most eminent pupils, Lucas Luscius and Nicolaus Senecker. Luscius is celebrated by music historians and liturgiologists for his unique position as the Protestant reformer who skillfully adapted the medieval plainsong music and Latin service, propers and ordinary, to the needs of the Lutheran Mass. Not only did he reveal himself as one of the best experts of his time on plainsong, but one for the Latin language its place in German Lutheran worship till the age of the Enlightenment. And in Luscius, we see also a remarkable churchman who added to his classroom efficiency by publishing religious textbooks in all the categories that we have discussed. The expounding of pericopes, books of memory materials, biblical history, and Bible study helps. He also wrote catechism materials. Here is a man worth knowing. Is Senecker worthy to be compared with Luscius? Was he not a man known for his confessional rancor and for unkind attacks against his foes? Perhaps, and yet this was one of the marks of the age. The fact that Senecker was one of the framers of the formula of Concord, helps locate his place in history. One may also think of Senecker as the man at Leipzig, who was largely responsible for the future course taken by the School of St. Thomas and its famous choir. Senecker himself was a musician, a hymn writer, and an organist. He was also an organizer of Latin schools. This particular school had a number of famous Latin teachers, men like Seth Calvisius, Johann Kuhnau, and Johann Sebastian Bach. Of the three, Bach was the least distinguished as a Latin teacher. He had certain other talents. And these men were all worthy successors of the tradition of Luscius and Senecker. They were worthy members of a remarkable education system which placed the humanities, the science of human values, above that of the material or the machine. Our age could learn much from these men.
I think that this was an extremely useful panel. I feel that I have about 3 years' work before me as a result. I believe that the business meeting of the conference is going to occur in this room after we are through. Yeah, Kyle? 4 o'clock. Well, then, that's fine, because that leaves those sturdy people who can still go to the business meeting and entertain a little bit more scholarly dialogue, that leaves us in control. And I think we'll sort of throw things open to discussion. I'm sure, Elizabeth, you had already been asking a few questions. Do you want to start off?
Well, I did just jump at some of the things that Mr. Cole said. I was invited by American University in Washington, D.C. And I couldn't help thinking, when you were talking about Hannibal, Robinson Crusoe, and the fact that he's accompanied by Friday. And I think there is a dual facet here. I mean, Robinson Crusoe runs into Hannibal, but he also is accompanied by a good man, Friday. And in connection with the travel literature, the mirage or the image that is formed of unknown peoples, and especially the primitive cultures, because there are two different facets here. There's the old civilization of China and the new world, or the old civilization of the Far East, a new world. In connection with new world, it seems to me the West forms a dual portrait. In one sense, you touched on it with your Franciscan comment about being innocent, free of original sin. There is already, it seems to me, you can find in the 16th century, some suggestion of the stereotype of noble savage as well as the cruel heathen. This is one comment. The second was a question of whether the print culture in itself and the study of the Bible in particular doesn't simultaneously develop a toleration for peoples of different faiths at different cultures, even while developing the intolerant stereotype or fixing it. And I'm thinking particularly of people like Castellio, whom our last speaker mentioned, but a whole group of Bible scholars who are associated with Diognetus Polyglot, later with the Antwerp Polyglot of Quentin, people like Postel, Guillaume Postel, with his ideas of Concordia, Mundi, the actual printing of the Quran by Oporinus in Basel seems to me indicative of an opening up of horizons, even while others are closing them off. So that I think we have to realize there are two possibilities here. One leads towards the idea of a family of man. And it seems to me within the household of the scholar printer who gathers around him Arabic, he has to, simply because of the nature of the Bible, he has to gather in his household people with expertise that go way beyond Christian classical horizons. This leads to an opening up within certain media, it seems to be an intellectual outlook, with regard to foreign or primitive people.
Well, I think your comment's a good one, and I think, too, you have to frame your comments, though, maybe on subsequent developments, say post-Enlightenment, even in the 19th century, in modern.
No, I was thinking really right back in the 17th century.
Yeah, I know, but you think, now what trend of this dualism that you talk about in the dominant one?
Both. The fact that you get up here as a representative of Western culture, feeling indignation.
Well, that's a good point. But
the intellectual community at the moment feels indignation of the stereotype is just as alive, just as much an imperative as the Enlightenment or the tradition I'm trying to get back to, which is that of the polyglot Bible scholarship, as those who feel uncritical acceptance of the stereotype.
Of course, Münster, I will put this in, because I use the Münster cosmography myself, and he does not confine his ethnocentrism to just the Western world. He has a marvelous description of France. Have you read this, Natalie? Well, he has a marvelous description of Paris, where he says everybody in Paris changes their clothes all the time, and they're very subject to fashion. It changes all the time. And as a matter of fact, the men wear their coats so short that it reveals their bare bottoms. And I have wondered, as a matter of fact, the word he uses is not bottom, and I've wondered whether to put it in the vernacular when I quote it. So that he, you know, he's also the German who just doesn't like France. In this sense, I think he
Of course, he collects all the, I think your statement, Richard, he's collected all the medieval legends and sort of wrapped them up into one.
The main part of cosmography really deals with Germany.
Yeah, and what a great place it is.
Yeah.
Like the thing that in the end of, you have this same thing in the end of Wimpfling's Germania, where he, you know, he says that all the Roman emperors, all the great Roman emperors were German, and all, and printing was founded by Germans, and all the great buildings have been built in Germany, and the Italians have to come up to Germany to find out how to learn how to print. Here's a very interview. You read that, Elizabeth?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think there is a total counter-offensive to the Italian. I mean, I think it all starts with the Italian celebration of the Renaissance. Don't you? I mean, as far as the German counter-offensive, printing is the one thing that they can sort of claim as opposed to Giotto through, you know, the great succession of painters and the great succession of literary achievements. They can claim the divine art. And is their one claim to fame. But don't you think this is part of their sort of counter-offensive to the Italian celebration of their virtue? But this German national theme
Natalie, you had a...
Well, I was just going to want to pursue further Betty's first point, because this same question struck me, thinking especially of very popular travel literature that I have from women in France. Wouldn't it be useful for us, first of all, to compare the degree of ethnocentricity prevalent in Europe with regard to Turks, for instance, in the pre-printing period, ethnocentricity derived from travelers' tales, crusaders' sermons, and from, of course, occasional encounters between Western scholars interested in pre-printing and conversion, the peaceful conversion of the Muslims. Wouldn't it be a useful thing for us to do in order to evaluate the strength of your claim about facing a stereotype, about printing ethnocentricity, to make a comparison between attitudes before and after? From what we know, I think that the strain of ethnocentricity is very strong before, and that the peaceful conversion types, like Nicholas Cusanus and so forth, are also very much in the minority. The ones that are interested in learning about non-Christian, Turkish Muslim society in order to convert. So that would be one thing I think we have to do in order to fix your claim. The second thing is, I would just reinforce what Betty says about the level of popular literature. If on the one hand, the stereotypes are shockproof, and maybe you can use your notion that maybe there is, we can therefore claim that they get, because they're in printed form, people believe them more firmly. I'm not so sure about that. But also, in some of this travel literature, there's a great deal of new information available about sometimes quite value-free descriptions of childbearing practice. I'm thinking of Pierre Belon's French in the vernacular, of course, travels to the Muslim country. Many sections don't even have, even worry about the noble savage. Sometimes you have that counter image, but sometimes it's just descriptions of food habits, child-rearing habits, educational habits, which become available, I would suspect, in much more widely than they were before in simple traveler's tales or oral accounts. So this is my only point, that I don't think we can only talk about the impact as being a standardization, as a sort of standardization, but also providing with people with critical information by which the stereotypes in the very long run, or even in the 16th century, might be criticized.
You've got another hand in the back of the room, I think.
I was just going to say, comparison to the pre-print period, you don't have any maps to fix this material on, so if you hear a report of a trip to Cathay, you don't know where to locate it, so that it's in a different context.
There wasn't, apparently. You want to counter that?
Well, I just say one point. You mentioned the pre-print age and what effect this might have. Well, certainly I think like Marco Polo's travels. But my question is there, who really read that?
Or who people talk. There are crusading sermons. Crusaders go back. People travel. That is, we have to compare accounts that, of course, continue all through the 16th century. People travel there too. And the attitudes generated by that method of communication.
Yeah.
Marco Polo's manuscripts, in other words, would be only one source. With what happens later, and we might find that perhaps the print culture offers both more information as well as fixing stereotypes. The paradox that they suggest.
Yeah.
But I think one of the greatest problems that we're going to have as we get into this popular literature is to know how much it is actually reflecting what people thought, how much it's actually creating opinion, how much one particular story will actually throw people in an opposite direction. I think the further you get in, the more you realize that you are traveling on perilous ground.
Right.